day on average are losing their limbs, one or both legs, during the Zionist regime's genocide on Gaza. Despite being accused of war crimes by the International Court of Justice and asked to enforce a ceasefire, the ethno-national regime operates with the agenda behind mutilation, total annihilation. The mutilation has been deliberately targeted at infrastructure, which started with the bombing of northern Gaza, implying there would be free land on which Zionists could live and even play games. At Shifa Hospital, its doctors, medical staff and patients were bombed, ensuring that Palestinians do not have the means to recover, and the structurally decimated building cannot be used for shelter. Mutilation has also been targeted at knowledge bases and archives, with the bombing of schools, universities and museums, disabling knowledge production through the burning of archives and books. Mutilation is also strategic, as different kinds of explosives are used to kill starving Palestinians who are drawn out by drones that play the sounds of women and children in distress. Humiliation was an evident precursor of mutilation when over 400 Palestinians were found in mass graves, their bodies showing signs of torture and execution.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Syrian citizens flocked to the polls on Monday to participate in elections for the fourth legislature. Following the 2012 constitutional amendments, voting stations opened at 7 a.m. and remained open until 7 p.m. President Assad and senior Syrian figures participated in this election, emphasizing their commitment to taking responsibility for the country's future.
The parliamentary elections, along with the presidential and local council elections, were organized smoothly and on time, demonstrating that we are a nation governed by institutions. Syria is entering a new phase of openness, requiring citizens to play a role in shaping the country's policies while moving forward. We are hopeful that the new parliament will fulfill its responsibilities.
A total of 1,516 candidates competed for the 250 seats in the Syrian parliament. Citizens viewed these elections as an opportunity to shape the country's future by electing representatives who would address their needs and aspirations.
We opened at 7 in the morning with representatives of all candidates present to ensure transparency. Voter turnout has been good so far, and we expect it to increase throughout the day. We are providing all necessary facilities to citizens in collaboration with relevant authorities.
With high hopes for their country's future, Syrians demonstrated a strong sense of responsibility through widespread participation, signifying a positive step towards recovery in the Arab nation.
Let's hope that our elected representatives fulfill the promises outlined in our electoral programs and help our country overcome the economic challenges. The reconstruction of Syria is a top priority for all Syrians.
Participating in these elections is a duty regarding my country. I'm voting for those who will work for the betterment of the people's conditions and fulfill our aspirations, particularly in improving the economic situation. I hope the candidate who truly serves the country's best interests wins.
These elections took place amidst a positive atmosphere fueled by the gradual opening that Syria is experiencing in various areas, paving the way for a return to normalcy. Experts believe the next parliament will play a significant role in shaping the country's future and setting its course for the next phase. Syrians are not only exercising their national rights and duty by voting in these elections, they are also showing the entire world that they can decide their fate and make a difference with their votes through democratic means. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Thank you. Rights campaigners are convinced that Israel is committing genocide and ethnic cleansing against Palestinians, actions blatantly supported by the United States and many EU nations. The death toll in Gaza continues to soar. People are starving and deprived of the most basic health care.
It's about an ideology, a Zionist ideology that was imported from Europe into our country, our own country of Palestine. And that ideology, its aim, I believe, in my own personal opinion, and it's been proven and it's been shown the case that they are trying to eliminate the Palestinian people and the Palestinian culture and history from all of the land of Palestine.
On Monday, after he met his Jordanian counterparts in Brussels, the EU's top diplomat, Joseph Borrell, again spoke out about the situation facing Palestinians.
I want to express my utter dismay over the unbearable climbing human cost and wide-scale destruction caused in Gaza by this conflict.
That's just the problem for EU policy critics. Instead of empty words, they are demanding economic sanctions and an arms embargo to be placed on the Israeli government. Additionally, the EU has been called upon to clarify its new plans to address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
We are looking at the possibility of facilitating medical evacuations jointly with member states and the WHO from the Gaza Strip to third or neighbouring countries in the region.
That response has been described as pitiful by those desperate to see adequate international support for dying Palestinians.
Europe stands with Israel.
European Commission boss Ursula von der Leyen set the tone for the EU when she travelled to Israel last October at the launch of Netanyahu's latest massacre. The EU's response, or lack thereof, to the atrocities has seriously undermined the bloc's credibility in the eyes of many. The question is being asked, is there literally no limit to what Israel can do before it faces consequences from the West? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
It's been 9 years since the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, also known as the Iran deal, was signed between Iran and several world powers in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The signatories to the 2015 landmark agreement were China, France, Germany, Russia, and the United Kingdom, apart from Iran and the United States. Under the agreement, the U.S. and the EU agreed to remove anti-Iran sanctions imposed over the years in exchange for Iran limiting its uranium enrichment and reducing its existing stockpile. The deal was eventually violated by the U.S. during the administration of President Donald Trump, who pulled out his country from the deal. That despite, Iran fully adhered to its part of the obligation under the JCPOA. Europeans also failed to salvage the accord by not complying to the accord.
The JCPOA had its pluses and its minuses. The biggest problem was that it was not protected. In other words, there were no real mechanisms to protect the deal if the Americans or the Europeans violated the agreement. And so when Obama began violating the deal, when he began to increase the sanctions, and of course the Europeans always obey the United States, there was no punishment. They paid no price for these violations. And then, of course, when Trump ultimately tore up the deal, it came at no political or economic cost for the United States.
The JCPOA was a result of 20 months marathon negotiations between the diplomats from Iran, the U.S., European countries, as well as China and Russia. These negotiations first led to the interim joint plan of action, concluded in 2013 in Geneva, then a framework agreement concluded in April 2015 in Lausanne, and finally on July 14, 2015 in Vienna. It was announced that the final agreement has been clinched.
If you think about the guarantee of the JCPOA, it is important to notice that there is no way in international relations that finally force the states to obey a regulation or a deal or a treaty among them. And that is why every party can withdraw illegally but practically from a deal, and that is why JCPOA was not the only treaty or was not the only deal that United States withdrew during Trump era and other times. Trump withdrew from Paris Agreement, from NAFTA, from the deal with Russia, from the tariff deal with China, and some others, many others.
Over the next 2 years following the signing of the deal, while Iran fully complied with the terms of the agreement, the unreliability of Americans was clear as they looked for pretexts to scale back their commitments. However, with Trump coming to the White House, as known for his close affiliation with the Israeli regime, the stage was set for nixing the accord. On May 8, 2018, Trump issued an executive order announcing that he was withdrawing the U.S. from the JCPOA. Trump's unilateral move virtually led to the collapse of the implementation of key provisions of the JCPOA, as the two main parties to the agreement were Iran and the U.S. Despite the U.S.'s withdrawal, Iran decided to remain a signatory to the agreement with the remaining parties, but with implementation of reciprocal measures in line with its parliamentary law. Fateh Masumi, Tehran. Muharram is the first month on the Islamic calendar. Every year during this month, mourners take to the streets and gather in mosques and other religious places to take part in different ceremonies for the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia Imam. The mourning rituals reach their peak on Ashura, the 10th day of Muharram, when Imam Hussein and his 72 companions were martyred in the Battle of Karbala in Iraq in the 7th century. On the first Friday of Muharram, similar ceremonies are held in dozens of countries across the globe to honor the youngest martyr of Karbala. Six-month-old Hazrat Ali Asghar was martyred on the day of Ashura. This year, Iranians marked the occasion in various cities and towns across the country. One of those ceremonies was held in the capital, Tehran, with thousands of mothers and their toddlers in attendance.
We are here for the innocence of those martyred in Karbala on the day of Ashura, especially the children like Ali Asghar. We are waiting for the arrival of Imam Zaman and we remain loyal to our leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. We are upset about the children of Gaza as they are killed by the Zionist regime. We wish the mothers in Gaza can also hold their children safely and freely in their arms without any fear of losing them.
Muharram and Karbala are the symbol of the perennial struggle between truth and falsehood, just and unjust, the relevance and significance of Imam Hussein's epic uprising against the then corrupt and despotic ruler in the plains of Karbala go beyond the boundaries of time and space. These annual commemorations amount to the reaffirmation of people's pledge of allegiance to the principles that the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, fought for.
As a mother, I'm here on this important day because Hazrat Ali Asghar, who was only 6 months old, was martyred by those who are very similar to Zionist regime killing innocent children in Gaza today. It's very heartbreaking. So all of these mothers here are praying for justice.
The movement, which has gripped the hearts and minds of people throughout history, is unfolding even today in Palestine, where Muslim men and women and children are killed and houses are flattened on a daily basis. What's unfolding in Palestine today is reminiscent of what took place 1,400 years ago, an apartheid regime which has occupied people's land, confiscated their properties, and driven them out of their homes, is today's version of the then tyrant empire at the time of the Battle of Karbala.
This year's mourners expressed their support for the oppressed Palestinians during Muharram ceremonies. Speaking up against injustice and oppression is the message of the Battle of Karbala and the legacy of Imam Hussein and Sayyida Zainab, peace be upon them. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
In light of tensions in South Lebanon and the genocide in Gaza, many have compared the escalations to the Israeli war on Lebanon in 2006.
On the 12th of July 2006, Hezbollah resistance fighters captured two Israeli soldiers near the southern border in hopes of achieving a prisoner swap and freeing Lebanese prisoners held in Israeli jails. The result was a land, air, and sea blockade and Israeli bombs raining down across the country for 33 days.
Mohammed was barely 10 years old when he woke up to celebrations and fireworks after the resistance operation, just before the all-out war began.
I was too young to understand the political ramifications of what happened and everything. I just woke up to celebrations, and next thing we know, we have to go out the house, you know? And we moved to my grandma's house at the time. And the first day of the war, we had to stay in, the underground garage of the building. Back then, we thought it was safe.
Although many experts believe the 2006 war was part of a U.S. plot to create what it called a new Middle East, the Israeli regime had declared it aimed to crush the resistance. But Hezbollah's deterrence capability came as a shock.
Taking into consideration the Arab-Israeli wars from 1948 until 2006, I think this war was the first war that Israel failed to accomplish its mission to occupy Lebanon or to advance in the Lebanese soil. So it is really a turning point in the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Despite similarities, the war pursued by Palestinian resistance factions inside Gaza is even more significant now.
We still remember the command and control, which succeeded in 2006 in defeating Israel. And now there is a perfect performance of the command and control in Gaza. So it's continuing the 10th month.
As a child who experienced the war in 2006, Mohammed was asked how he relates the war to the ongoing genocide in Gaza.
It's shameful for me to even say that it's as close as what they're going through. And even though it was traumatizing, it did leave a mark on me, but it's nothing compared to what they're going through.
The war in 2006 left at least 1,000 Lebanese civilians killed, around 4,400 injured, and an estimated 1 million displaced. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The new European Parliament is scheduled to hold its first session next week, and its composition is poised to create major headaches for the political establishment. On Wednesday, the Europe of Sovereign Nations was established, a far-right faction consisting of 25 MEPs from 8 member states.
The whole situation with far-right created as a protest of the refusal of the pro-European forces to hear the citizens. And we see that not only in France, we see that in Germany, we see that in the other countries.
Viktor Orban's nationalist group, Patriots for Europe, has also been officially formed in the European Parliament. With 84 MEPs from various EU nations, it stands as the third largest group in the hemicycle. Amongst other things, these far-right groups oppose refugees and are actively campaigning against the reappointment of European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. According to analysts, this surge is being driven by concerns over immigration, economic instability, and a perceived loss of national sovereignty. But it also challenges the EU's so-called core values of unity and diversity. The leading voice in the newly formed Europe of Sovereign Nations grouping is Germany's AfD, whose members occupy more than half of the group's seats.
So are you concerned for the future of the EU project because of this shift towards the far right and the ongoing struggles that ordinary people seem to have?
To basically conclude that they're voting this way or that way based on a very limited set of issues is, let's put it this way, perhaps a bit oversimplifying the situation, and I'm not going to get into that.
Despite often holding views considered extreme by many, anti-war campaigners are at least satisfied that the new far-right groups oppose any new funding towards the conflict in Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In a series of precise military operations, the Yemeni armed forces targeted multiple Israeli and American vessels. In the Arabian Sea, the American ship Merc Sentosa was hit by a combination of ballistic and winged missiles in a joint operation by naval and missile forces.
The naval forces and the drone and missile forces of the Yemeni army carried out several operations as follows. The American ship Maris Sentosa was targeted in the Arabian Sea by naval and missile forces in a joint operation with a number of ballistic and winged missiles. The hit was direct and accurate.
The Martha Pauls ship was also targeted successfully in the Arabian Sea by drones. This operation was justified as the ship owner violated the Yemeni ban on vessels entering Israeli ports in occupied Palestine. Additionally, Israeli ship MSC Patnari was struck in the Gulf of Aden with the UAVs. Sana'a vows that it will continue such operations to defend Yemen's territorial integrity until the US, Britain, and Israel cease their aggression against the Arab country.
The Yemeni operation is in response to the actions taken by the United States, Britain, and the Israeli regime against Yemen. It will continue until they stop their crimes and pressure neighboring countries in ending their economic blockade on us. If the military aggression continues, the Yemeni army will respond more forcefully against the aggressor countries that are following Washington's directives.
Meanwhile, American media reports have drawn attention to a notable shortage of aircraft carriers within the U.S. Navy. This shortage is critical as the Navy faces multiple threats amid the Yemeni attacks. The situation highlights a significant weakness of the U.S. naval capacity to address global security challenges and escalating regional tensions.
Yemeni military officials have confirmed their readiness to take additional measures against entities that support Israeli interests or provide military backing to American and Israeli forces. They believe that Washington's push to militarize international waters poses increased risks to global maritime navigation. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Illuminating quotes by Ayatollah Khamenei on Imam Hussein's uprising. On the day of Ashura, Zainab al-Kubra watched many of her dear ones to go to the battlefield to get martyred. She watched Hussein ibn Ali, Abbas, Ali Akbar, Qasim, her children and other dear ones to go to the battlefield. After they were martyred, she went through all those pains. The invasions of the enemy, disrespect, and the responsibility to take care of the surviving children and women. Is it possible to compare the enormity of this tragedy with physical pain? But when she was faced with these difficulties, Zainab al-Kubra did not tell God to save her. She did not say, "Oh my Lord, save me." While the shredded body of her brother lay in front of her eyes, tells God, "Oh God, accept this sacrifice from us." When she was asked to describe what she had seen, she replied, "I did not see anything but beauty." All those tragedies were beautiful to Zainab al-Kubra because they were from and for God, because they were supposed to promote the word of God.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What Zainab salawatullah alayha did was divine. That is to say, she went into the heart of threats and hardships for the sake of Allah the Exalted. It behoves us to know and to understand our glorious history, which has been a source of intellectual blessings so far and which will hopefully benefit us until the end of time. Zainab played an unparalleled role on the way to Karbala with Imam Hussein, on the day of Ashura with all those hardships and after Imam Hussein alayhi salam had been martyred. It is impossible to find a similar figure in history. Later on, numerous events took place during her captivity in Kufa and in Sham. Because of these great selfless efforts, Zainab al-Kubra salawatullah alayha gained a prominent position before Allah the Exalted, and this is something that we cannot describe. All days of the year are essentially the same. It is human beings, their determination, and selfless efforts that make certain days prominent and turn them into a flag to guide other people. Ashura, the 10th of Muharram, is not in itself different from other days. It was Imam Hussein alayhi salam who gave life and meaning to that day and raised its position. It was the selfless efforts of Hussein ibn Ali's companions that made Ashura so important.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, in a country which was founded on violence and one where currently there are more guns than people, it should not be a surprise that once again the United States has witnessed political violence. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was shot in the ear during an assassination attempt. This is a country where almost 10% of the presidents have been assassinated, and even more attempted assassinations. But why? Well, stay with us as we look at all of this and what it means on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Rochester, New York, David K. Johnston, investigative journalist, author, and founder of DCRReport.org. Out of Tampa, Florida, Neil McCabe, conservative political commentator and national political reporter for RedState.com. Thank you both for being with me. I'd like to start this off with David in Rochester. Let's look at a statement made by U.S. President Joe Biden regarding the assassination attempt. And he said that there's not a place for this kind of violence in America. Your thoughts about this statement, and what exactly does it mean when in the U.S., I mean, there are at least 44,000 Americans that are killed every year by guns?
Well, I think the number killed is 24,000, not 44,000, and that's homicides.
Killed by guns means homicides and suicides, so altogether. Okay. But go ahead, yeah.
But not all homicides are by gun, and not all suicides are by gun.
But these are by gun. Sorry to interrupt you. I just want to be exact because it's really important as a journalist. Yeah. When I was researching this, it was considered homicides and suicides by gun. But go ahead.
Okay. Without a question, there is way too much gun violence in the world. There is no modern, mature economy in the world, no democracy in the world, anywhere near the level of the United States when it comes to gun violence. And it is the goal of Donald Trump and many of his supporters that there be no rules whatsoever about carrying guns. The Second Amendment of the American Constitution doesn't refer to guns, it refers to arms. And I have written in the past that if you want to be an absolutist about the Second Amendment, we now have nuclear weapons that will fit in a backpack, and I want a personal nuclear weapon because nobody will mess with me if I'm carrying one around. Clearly, we have a problem in the U.S. with people having weapons like the one used in an attempt to kill Donald Trump that are intended to be military weapons used on the field of battle, don't belong in the civilian arena. But in America, you can walk into a restaurant, a movie theater, a department store, and you will see people carrying not just guns on their hips, but assault rifles slung over their shoulder.
Yeah, that's pretty frightening. Well, Neil, I mean, let's talk about this in general, because would you say that the United States is just in general a very violent society? I mean, we remember even the violence that took place, let's say, on January 6, 2021. Do you think that Americans in general seem to feel that by taking up guns, I mean, it's more of an American tradition? David just talked about the Second Amendment, and the roots may lie there. But, I mean, your overall assessment?
Well, I think humans are violent people, and in America, people are free to be humans. And there are less controls that we see in other countries. And the Founding Fathers, and for the last 250-plus years, we've basically made the decision that we would rather have freedom than too much government control. And I want to remind you that the American Revolution started at Lexington and Concord because King George and his troops were sent to get the guns from the farmers that they were storing in Lexington. Mm-hmm. And so it's really interwoven into the American story, into the American DNA, that to have a free society, to have a free country, that Americans have the freedom to be armed. Not everybody wants to be armed. Not everybody is armed. But for the people who want to protect themselves, their families, their farms, their livelihood, well, that should be their right. And certainly when the mob is marching down the street, you know, looking to attack and looking to burn down buildings, when there is a failure of the government to preserve tranquility, what other choice do Americans have?
And let's talk about that, because isn't that the responsibility of any government actually to make sure that their society is secure,
not the individual citizens? So what happens, like we saw it in Los Angeles, 20, 30 years ago, when there were the L.A. riots and the police literally abandoned the Korean neighborhoods? There was zero protection as there was mayhem and chaos in that neighborhood. The Korean Americans had to go to the rooftops to protect their neighborhoods. Mm. We saw it at Uvalde in Texas. We saw it in the nightclub shootings. And then we see another failure in Butler, Pennsylvania. just because law enforcement fails doesn't mean you take away the rights of Americans, because the Americans want that right in case government fails. Mm. It's a circular argument that does not help people make them safe.
Right, right. It's actually quite mind-boggling, can I say. Well, David, when the United States was actually founded on violence, and currently there are more guns than there are people, are you surprised by this event, by this assassination attempt?
No. I mean, we don't know much about the young man, a Republican, who shot at Donald Trump, and I hope you find out much more. But let me point out that we have always had gun controls in the United States, including in the British colonial era, under the First American Republic, which only lasted 7 years, and under the Constitution. In Dodge City, Kansas, now that is the iconic image town for the frontier Old West, you were required at the city limits to holster your weapon and to go to the sheriff's office and to turn it in. You were not allowed to go down the street, to go to a bar, to do anything armed with a gun. And the idea that individual Americans are better off with all these guns, I think, is disproven by the fact that no other democratic or modern country allows this, and nobody else has the level of gun deaths that we do in America. So I reject totally your other guest's argument that
David, let's be honest, okay, David. When you're driving through Washington, D.C., David,
let's not
when you're driving through David, when you're driving through Trenton, New Jersey, you don't want to be armed. Are you crazy?
I go to Trenton, New Jersey fairly often, and also I don't interrupt people. Try to have some manners. Stop being aggressive. I go to Harlem. I go to many places, and I'm somebody who has personally hunted down murderers and confronted them and gotten them arrested. So, yes, I have no problem with that. I live five blocks outside of one of the cities that has one of the highest murder rates in America. But it turns
out... You're not armed, David?
It turns out that almost all the crime occurs in 3 of 40 zip codes. It's highly concentrated. And what you're spewing
David,
is just classic
David,
racism.
You're also filibustering.
Okay, stay with me, Neil.
I thought this would have a conversation. He's just ranting, and I'm never going to get a word
in. It's your turn now. Go ahead, Neil.
First of all, I just want to address the quick point that the United States was created out of violence. I would say virtually every country was created by an act of violence. I mean, they just happen to, it's a revolution if the rebels win, it's a civil war if the government wins.
It was also a genocide of the Native Americans. Let's remember we're talking about genocide.
Let's deal with the United States. Let's deal with the United States in the context of other countries rather than comparing us with Candyland. First of all. Second of all, Americans are not feeling safe. We do not feel protected by our government. We do not feel protected by law enforcement. And when government fails, Americans want the right to protect themselves. And that's the bottom line. The vast majority of American gun owners wish to God that they did not have to have a gun. But this is a decision forced upon them by the failure of the government to create a tranquil society. What we saw in Butler, Pennsylvania, was a failure of law enforcement. What we saw at Uvalde was a failure. What we saw at these school shootings is a failure, where law enforcement will literally wait for the victims to bleed out rather than to seek the killer and take him down. Mm. And so what are we supposed to do? Honestly, you know, he can say David feels safe going through Harlem. He feels safe going through Trenton. He feels safe going through these neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. God bless him, because in Washington, D.C., Sotomayor, the Supreme Court Justice of the United States, was carjacked like a week ago. I mean, so if you have a Supreme Court justice who isn't safe in Washington, D.C., then where are we?
So wouldn't you say then that the problem, there's something more fundamental here with the problem, that the people, the individual people, have to protect themselves? I mean, it's not the old West. We're talking about 2024. Yeah. There are systems that are in place throughout the world that societies are safe. So what is it about the United States that it is not safe?
Well, maybe we should stop hugging the thugs and put them in jail and keep them in jail. Maybe we need to expand the death penalty so that families of victims understand that what they went through is valuable to society, and so that criminals understand that they will be held accountable. Criminals do not feel like they will be held accountable in this country. They go to jail where they are treated very well and they're pampered. They get their master's degree. The victims, the children of their victims can't go to college, but the murderers get their master's degree in college.
Okay.
It's an absurd system that we have in this country.
Well, David, I mean, there is a long history of violence in politics in the U.S. If we look at the 60s and 70s, where several people were assassinated, from President John F. Kennedy to Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Robert Kennedy, and others. And, of course, in the 80s, we had President Ronald Reagan. And an attempted assassination that was shot. So political violence is not foreign to this society. I want your assessment overall of this, and why is this the case in your perspective?
Well, political violence absolutely has been endemic to American society from the beginning, whether it was, as you pointed out, the taking of land from the indigenous peoples here, right up to the shooting yesterday of Mr. Trump and the unfortunate supporter of his who was killed. Gun violence begets gun violence. More guns equals more killings. The simple fact is the U.S. is an outlier in the world in terms of its gun violence, the amount of guns it has. And I take it that your other guest, unlike me, has not spent a great deal of his life with law enforcement and talking to people who are criminals. Prisons, putting people in prison, simply breeds more crime. It doesn't address the reasons that we have crime. Now, I'm sure that your other guest won't agree with that whatsoever, but look at Canada, Australia, New Zealand, England, France, Italy. They don't have any level of crime like we do in America, and we don't have any level of homicides by gun as in the United States. There is no reason for a civilian to carry an assault rifle, a weapon specifically designed to kill as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, in a military battlefield.
Okay, well, Neil, Republican Congressman Mike Kelly from Pennsylvania says the blame lies somewhere in the psyche of America. Your thoughts on that statement? What do you think he meant by that?
It boggles my mind that he would say something so stupid. I can't read the congressman's mind, and I doubt very much that he can read the mind of America. I think that the bottom line is that if Americans feel threatened, they should have the right to arm themselves. And if someone's going to tell me that I can't protect my family, I can't protect myself, my business, the people I care about, then I'm really offended. And the idea that I'm supposed to just take my chances because of some stupid ideal that somebody cooked up in academia or wherever it came from, it's absurd. In the real world, most Americans who own guns wish they didn't have to own a gun, but they do it out of necessity. And they do it out of love for them, for themselves, their family, their livelihood, and their community. The people who walk around their communities with who are armed, they are like shepherds amongst us. Okay, a best case scenario for a cop showing up at a shooting is 10 or 15 minutes. Okay, by the time the cops show up, they're just putting yellow tape around the crime scene and taking statements. If someone is armed and at the scene, they can take down the threat in seconds. And that saves lives. And there are no statistics for all of the crimes and all of the lives saved because Americans are armed. But I would guess it's probably a million a year of these things that go on. And it's never happened to me personally, but I know a number of people who have saved their own lives and the lives of others just by brandishing a weapon and getting themselves out of a very dangerous situation. But your alternative for them would be put your weapon down, get shot, and in 15 minutes, a police officer will show up and take crime pictures.
Yeah. Can I just say, I mean, this is a very interesting conversation for me as an American, growing up in the United States and living in Iran now, a country where, as I am a woman, I can actually, in this major city of Tehran, I don't know, 10 million people, that I can actually go out and walk at 2 o'clock in the morning by myself and not expect to get shot. So it's really mind-boggling why the United States, with its sophistication, technology, being the hegemon of the world, why it cannot keep its own people safe. I mean, I guess this is the main question at hand. But let me just go on. I mean,
I would guess that in Iran they don't let the criminals out of jail. I think that the justice system in Iran is swift and appropriate, and if somebody rapes and murders a child, I imagine they don't get 3 years with probation.
Yeah, that's for sure.
In Iran.
That's for sure. If someone rapes and murders a child, that is definitely for sure. That is the case. Well, David, I mean, let's talk about this whole situation, because, I don't know, sitting here, it seems somewhat ironic that we have Trump and also Biden, both individuals, let me just say, who have allowed and ordered assassinations of other people. But now there's such outrage because, I mean, I'm so sorry, but this is what we see from the United States. Whether we're talking about under Donald Trump, that he assassinated, of course, we know Lieutenant Colonel Soleimani, who was in another country, who had fought the terrorists, the Daesh terrorists, and Trump ordered the assassination in another country, even though he was invited by Iraq and bragged about it. Or we're talking about Biden, who is supporting right now a genocide in Gaza of Palestinian babies who've been cut to pieces. So it's amazing the outrage. I mean, your take, David.
Well, the world is, look, a very complicated place. And unlike Neil, who just said he was speaking for millions of Americans, but the congressman doesn't know the mind of Americans, I'm not going to try to do that. The fact is that the president of the United States, because the U.S. is a de facto empire, whoever it is going to end up using his position as commander-in-chief to order killings of people. And some of those are going to be really bad decisions, as with the Iranian military officer, where it provoked unnecessary responses. It is one thing to shoot a sniper. It's another thing to pick out a political target, as Donald Trump did. And part of the reason for that is Donald, who I've known for 36 years, have written 3 best-selling books about him, and I was the first person to write that he might become president of the United States in 1988, 36 years ago. Donald doesn't know anything. If you ask Donald what's the difference between a Sunni and a Shia, he would have no idea. And I don't expect most Americans to know that, but the president of the United States better know that very well. So there are always contradictions in the world. I think the issue about violence in America that needs to be addressed is that we have over 390 million guns in this country. No other country has a gun ownership rate anything like that. We allow any kind of gun. You have to show identification to buy certain kinds of medicine if you have a cold at the drugstore, but not if you buy an assault rifle and the bullets that go in it. And that's the core of the problem here. And combined with that, we get things like Neil making up history and not recognizing that we've always had gun controls in America, as my example showed with Dodge City, Kansas.
Well, Neil, though there has been calls for national unity, I have been monitoring social media after this assassination attempt. How likely is this to cause greater division in the country, as there are many questions still surrounding the overall assassination attempt?
Well, because of our political system, especially as you get closer and closer to the election, and then very much during the election when there's actual voting. This system forces people into a binary choice, which is why, you know, there's always talk of third-party candidates. In fact, Abraham Lincoln was a third-party candidate. But in the end, it's black or it's white, you know, and that's it. And so, you know, there's going to be division because our system forces you to make a decision. In effect, there's no middle ground. You either pick the Republican or you pick the Democrat. But, you know, to go back to your really, I think the point of this conversation is political violence in the United States. I do want to point out that the leader of the Republican Party, who got more than 70 million votes in 2020, there was an attempt to kill him, and yet no cities were burned, nobody was tearing down any statues, no police stations were torched. And so at least on the Republican side, which, you know, was often besmirched as sort of the party of so-called insurrectionists, there was no political violence in response to this assassination attempt on President Trump. I don't know if you could say the same if it happened to someone on the left. I suspect, since it's been my experience as a reporter covering Antifa and Democratic politics, even in Massachusetts with the Carpenters Union, that political violence is very much a part of left-wing politics.
Okay, David, any final comments? You have 30 seconds.
Well, I think we need to recognize that violence in America is a long endemic problem, that Donald Trump has repeatedly made public calls for violence. He's told people to beat up people in his audience and he'd pay their legal bills, which he would never do. And Donald Trump is a man of violence. He's called for the executions of people who didn't even get trials, like the Central Park Five, who were later exonerated. And you have to see him in that context. He's not a politician. He's a con artist who has declared he wants to be our dictator, something I said in 2015 and wrote in 2016 would be his plan. He would never peacefully leave the White House, and that's what we saw with his failed coup 3 years ago.
Okay. All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. David K. Johnston, investigative journalist, author, and founder of DCReport.org out of Rochester, New York. Neil McCabe, conservative political commentator, national political reporter for RedState.com out of Tampa, Florida. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.